grateful to Pabanaba Maharaj, feeling very grateful to Bhakti Ras, feeling very grateful to Yuga Kishore and all the devotees that are organizing this Sangha. Thank you so much for inviting me here and allowing me the opportunity. It's anytime I find the opportunity to speak about something, it really just means it's an opportunity for me to think about something. So I very much appreciate being here. Before we dive in with the presentation and hopefully generate some dialogue at the end, I'll just chant a few prayers of invocation. Namashreshtam Manumapi Satchiputram Atvaswarupam Rupam Tasyagujim Urupurim Maturim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhikamadavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tam Natosmi Namaste Gurudevaya Sarvasiddhipradayine Sarva Mangala Rupaya Sarvanandavidayini Radheshakeli Prabhutavino Ravinyasavigyam Vajavanditangrim Kripadutadya Kila Vishravanyam Tripunamasi Shilasya Namami Govardhanujayate Shailakulari Rajo Yagopikabirudito Krishna Shakramukabangakatachitoya Saptahamasyakarapadmatalephyavasti Anupamamaniveriradnasinghasnoruvi Uhajaradarashanudronisangeshurangai Shahabalashakibishankeleyanswapriyamenijinikatanivashamdehi Govardhanatvam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivashari Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Panchakalpaturubhyascha kripasindubhyevacha Patitanam bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Mukam karoti vachalam bhangam langaite girim Yatkripatamaham vande Shri Gurum dinatarinam Thank you, dear devotees. So today, the topic I hope to explore with you all is a topic that's just most alive for me when Bhakti Ras Mata reached out and asked if I would be open to doing this. I was very excited at the prospect, and then also wasn't exactly sure of what I would speak about at first. I would say, very openly and honestly, I'm not in a extremely scholarly phase of my life. And so then there was a concern that, oh, I don't have some like Shastric scholarly thing that I could speak about. Not that we're trying to be scholars, or not that that's the only qualification to speak. But that was the insecurity that arose in my mind. But then she had kind of suggested a few different topics, specifically when I had spoken with Padmanabha Maharaj not long ago on his podcast, Free Radicals, and we had had a discussion kind of around male spirituality. But it kind of turned more into my current reflections on fatherhood, an identity that I've just recently really entered into, and a profound, thank you, and a profound container to be experiencing. And the specific name actually came from 2 weeks ago, when, or however long ago, was when my dear friend Ujwala, when he spoke in this Tadatmya Sangha, and he spoke about love. And so I think even on that same day, we had And I'll tell more a little bit about this, but we were in Ohio, Hocking Hills, Ohio, which is a beautiful, like, people think of Ohio, I feel like many people think of Ohio and they think of it's just kind of like a wasteland. But in southern Ohio, there's this beautiful place, just like people think poorly about Michigan. Let them think that. Michigan and Ohio are beautiful places. It's great. So in Ohio, Hocking Hills, Ohio, it's like the beginning of the Appalachian Trail. And these beautiful rolling hills and caves and caverns and just beautiful sandstone caverns, caves, excuse me, that many, hundreds of years ago, the natives of this land would go and they would sit and pray. And so one of those mornings we had gone to do some chanting in one of these caves, and I was speaking that night previously, my daughter had decided to have a party most of the night. So I had very little sleep. Normally she's a very good sleeper. But that particular night before we left, I had very little sleep. And because of that, well, in concomitant to that, I slept through my alarm. And so there was a lament that was coming up for me because we had all agreed that we were going to go and we were going to meet like early in the morning at this cave. And I had like slept in an hour past when I wanted to sleep in. And so anyway, we were talking about that, and Ujwala said very presciently, he said, "Well, she's your fire," referring to the fire of sacrifice, the fire of atonement, the fire of prayer, the fire of ceremony, that center focal point, which all wise cultures orient themselves knowingly or even unknowingly. Fire is the engine of all humanity, of all spiritual inclination, of even industrial growth. Human beings and fire have this integral relationship, specifically in their connection to God. And again, whether they're conscious of that or unconscious of that. And so in reference to that, he said, "She's your fire." And so that's been a thing that I've been contemplating in many ways and really wanting to generate more thought and art and reflection around. So when Bhakti Rasa asked, this kind of just came to me, the fire of father approaches. So my hope in the next 45 minutes or so, 40 minutes, is really to unpack some of these reflections, hopefully in a way that it's not just relevant to someone exactly like me who's a father of a daughter, although that's the perspective that I'm speaking from. But hopefully to unpack a little bit more of this framework around sacrifice and using this fire analogously as a reflection of how we approach the center. It's been something that I've been, and I know Jai Jagannath Prabhu spoke a little bit ago about the halo, like the kind of the circle, ceremony work, circle work. So it's been a thread in my own life and in my circle. And definitely in a time, I'm listening to the Mahabharata. I listen to the Mahabharata like once a year. And the Pandavas are just finishing up their exile, 13 years in the forest. And I was thinking of 13 years, and I've essentially been trying to practice bhakti for 13 years. And I was like, wow, 13 years it's not a long time, but it's also a very long time. Like that was the last decade and some change of my life. And just kind of thinking that in perspective to the Pandavas, how long they are in the forest. So anyway, a bit of a side, but after this 13 years of trying to practice bhakti and trying to sincerely approach and grow, there's definitely a space of new discovery and wonder and redefining what is my relationship with the center, with Krishna? What is my relationship to my tradition? I think the sign of sickness is if I feel like I can't question that. The sign of disease is if we have a culture where we're not willing to express doubts, concerns, reconsider, redefine, reorient. I think human life, my personal experiences, is meant for consistent reorientation. So, these are my reflections around that, on my reorienting specifically through the container of having a daughter and how she's and being a husband and a father and how these two powerful women in my life are bringing that out of me in a very profound way. So when we think of fire, it's interesting. I in doing some basic research for this discussion, I was looking up like tips on, running a fire, or tips on like basically just like what are best practices for having a fire. And like 90% of the Google searches were all about like fire safety and all the things that can go wrong and like fire extinguishers and like all those other things, which was interesting because I guess in my mind, my intention was, like dry wood and, like actual like pot tips in the positive of like how to maintain a fire. But what was the main concern? And then in reflecting, like this is often either like the poles, right? It's either like the fear of fire, of like what fire can do and like the destructive power of fire, right? Or it's like the exploitation of fire, right? There tends to be these poles, that exist around anything on, with fire. This is the continuum: fear on one side or exploitation on the other, which is kind of, when we think of speaking from the perspective of a brahmachari, right? Sometimes, the life of the celibate towards the feminine sometimes is, exposed in this type of continuum, which isn't healthy. To like fear women is not healthy, nor to like exploit women is unhealthy. But oftentimes, like especially our society as men, oftentimes that's just kind of the default. That's either what we've seen more on the side of like exploitation, but also on the side of fear, like the temptress, how she's going to damn, this kind of polarity, unhealthy polarity, creates a lot of the dysfunction. And so with fire, same kind of thing. Obviously, there's that, butter and fire analogy for any young brahmachari that's ever, joined the ashram. Well, ooh, women are like fire and you're like butter, And so there's this kind of, weird dichotomy that's created, but really the center path, the balanced approach is fire provides illumination and warmth, right? And life, right? And this is the center. So this is really like, how do we approach the fire? The fire father approaches, how do we approach? And this is going to be my reflections on how I'm praying and trying and endeavoring to approach my wife and to approach my daughter. But ultimately, this reflection on how do I approach the center, right? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Aham Kraturham Yajna, Swadaham Aham Aushadham Mantraham Aham Evajam, Aham Agnir Aham Hutam. I am the healing herb. I am the mantra. I am the sacrifice. I am the fire. I am the center. And so much of our great tradition and culture is built around, the purifying effect that fire has, right? All consuming fire, the way fire can take really anything, even garbage, and make it into usable carbon, right? Although sometimes that's not a practice that should necessarily be encouraged. We don't want to be burning plastics and other things, but fire will do it. Fire will take it and purify it, right? Fire is the receptor of all sacrifice and yajna, any type of homa, dumping in, it's said to be the mouth of Vishnu, right? So both practically, analogous metaphorically, and spiritually, fire as the center is such a powerful anchor. Especially if, I mean, remember the last time you've sat in front of a fire, and the natural way it evokes contemplation, community, humanity, conversation. Anytime I sit at a fireplace or at a campfire, I'm so enthralled. It's such an enthralling thing to just look at a fire. The beauty, it's so captivating. So my hope is to explore a little bit more of this illumination and warmth approach and life-giving approach. And this is my attempt in meditation and how I want to, again, approach my wife and approach my daughter. So my wife, Sriradha Devi, who I think is probably listening on YouTube right now, she said something profound the other day, just in her own experience. We're having a conversation, and she was saying in the female body, like the female body is almost pre-installed with austerity. There's a lot of the initiation that takes place for women is built into the way their bodies change. There's an inherent way that austerity is, it's a part of the lining of having a female body. So, but for men, oftentimes the men need to seek out, proactively seek out austerity and initiation and training, really. And in days bygone, we hear of the way in which culture was much more centered around how it kept safe and kept thriving and protecting the women and children, and how men would need to go through training and initiation in order to really like then become the provider. So there was almost for both sexes, there was a way in which that the natural austerity that brought us to the fulfillment of our potential in that lifetime was there and present. Whereas now it can often be that men have an easier time trying to avoid austerity. I think with the introduction of so much comfort and convenience, it can be easy for men to just kind of insipidly avoid the austerity that they would otherwise have to proactively seek out. And it was a profound reflection in just thinking of my experience as a man, and how it's easy for me to glide if I want to. It's easy for me to zone out, to drop off, not engage. But the idea of the fire that a father approaches is, as a man, I need to approach the fire. I need to proactively approach the fire and take on the austerity, which is actually for my betterment, right? So one of the things that fire does is, again, it illuminates my shortcomings, right? As a man, as I approach the fire, it begins to show me all the places that I am not facing the center. That illumination does two things. It obviously illuminates, and it also casts shadows. What exposes the shadows, right? A shadow is not necessarily shadows created, on one hand, depends on how you look at it. Shadow can be created, but it's because something then is obstructing the light, right? The place that is shadowed is not inherently shadowed, but it is the thing that is then obstructing the light from reaching that place. In other words, it's something before the shadowed space that is the cause of the shadow. So similarly in our heart, it is not that the darkness in our heart is inherently darkness. It's that there is something causing that shadow. Dunya, she has one of that song. What's her line? She says something. Oh my gosh, I wish I. It just came to me. She has a song, and she has a lyric where it says, "Where I see the shadow, it's because the light." I forget. Now I'm gonna kick myself. I'll have to look it up during the questions. Anyway, this point is that as the fire illuminates, it illuminates the shortcomings. by showing, okay, what are the things that are preventing, what are the things that are getting in my way of living into my fullest potential? Or am I being inattentive, right? Specifically with my daughter, right? Anytime there's a, you know, there's a level of, I mean, she's very forgiving and patient and loving, but at the same time, like there's a vigilance that needs to take place in taking care of a small human, and in being aware of their needs and responding to their needs. And so my approach to this fire is obviously, how do I need to, what are all like all the ways that I need to grow spiritually, professionally, emotionally, physically? All those ways are become very evident, especially approaching, you know, the fire of my daughter, the fire of my wife. My whole experience in marriage has been a refinement and encouragement and growth. And this is really what the fire is for. Okay. Another thing that fire does is, again, we mentioned it consumes, right? In traditional times when humanity would sit around the fire to pray, right? Especially in South American cultures, the reflection is that we have these prayers and we offer these prayers into the fire, and then the fire carries those prayers up to heaven, up to the Lord. And in the fire that has been my in the fire of my daughter, right, I'm seeing how there's such an invitation of an invitation to pray, and recognizing that being able to direct my prayers, like direct my attention and my service, there's a very real way in which that I'm learning how to serve by being a father, by being a husband. And it's there's two options. You could break it down to a dichotomy. As a man, I could resent that, the fact that now someone else is clearly in the center, right? That if I don't live in such a way that those two individuals are in the center of my life, it becomes very it can be very violent to them in terms of just like them not getting the care and love and support that they need. But it also, you know, it forces me to like challenge my own ego, which wants to be the center of everything. Or it's the brilliant reminder that that is ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is that I'm not the center, that God is the center, Krishna is the center, right? So by directing my attention to my wife and daughter, by directing my love and care and support, and like allowing myself to be in front of that fire, I'm actually called deeper into prayer, because realizing to actually provide the support and the care that they need, I cannot fully provide that. And so this is tying into, as we approach the fire, and illuminates our shortcomings, right? The illumination of our shortcomings should encourage us to surrender and depend more deeply on the fire. Realizing that, you know, I can provide something to the fire. I can provide fuel to the fire, but the fire will ultimately burn on its own accord. I am not the creator of fire, right? Not even the founder of fire. Fire is existing. It's such an ephemeral kind of substance, if you will. In the Bhagavatam, it's said to represent form. That's where, as the different elements kind of, as they develop into this world, fire is what brings us form, primarily because it gives vision, but also because fire itself has some sort of form. Before, you know, before earth, you know, you have air or ether, you have water, and then you have fire. Or maybe it goes fire first, right? But it's of the more subtle elements, but it is the first element which introduces form, right? So the last point that I think I would love to dive into and then open it up for some conversation, some question, because I feel like would love to ground back into the conversation here is the tendency of overdependence, because I was reflecting upon the fire and one has to stay close to the fire and tend to the fire. And again, I have to be a present father, be a present husband, and I have to tend to those things. But again, if there's the overdependence, if I become overdependent upon the fire and I just stay at the fire until it burns away, I'll run out of fuel. I won't be able to put fuel in the fire to keep the fire alive. And the fire won't ultimately be there to nourish me, right? So in order to feed the fire, I have to leave the fire, right? I have to go out and venture into the unknown. I have to explore and discover more parts of me to be able to bring something back to the fire, right? And that's where this the fire of father approaches, whether it's in the form of my daughter and my wife, whether it's in the form of my prayer, my ceremony, my relationship with Krishna, whether it's in the form of my broader community. In order to feed the fire, I have to leave the fire. There's something that I have to go out, seek, and bring back. So, with that being said, would love to see if there's any comments or questions or anything that we can just dive a little bit deeper into.
Well, thank you, Ananda Murariji. Beautiful, beautiful metaphors and analogies from this symbol of fire. I have a few things that maybe we can stoke some discussion.
Yeah, please stoke the fire.
And also, of course, if anyone's listening, I see a few people online, so feel free to type questions into the chat, and I will get those over to Ananda G. I love the, this concept of fire symbolizing life. And I have a few questions I wrote down. I'm just trying to see here where to dive in. For one thing, it brought up a point that my Gurudev many years ago said to me. I was having some struggles staying in the ashram, fitting in. I felt like I did not fit in. And I ended up not staying there very long. And he gave me this analogy of guru as fire, that too close and we can get burned. Not close enough, and we can go cold. So maybe you can speak something to, of course, your symbolism of fire here. We're talking about relationship, especially as father or husband. But what about that relationship, maybe between teacher and student, between simply, fire as knowledge? Maybe you could say something to that.
Yeah, great point. Yeah, too close to the fire and one can get burnt, too far from the fire and one can go cold. And again, like the last point I made about when one needs to leave the fire in order to feed the fire. But if the intention is not well established of returning to the fire in order to feed the fire, then one can get lost in the woods. One can again just get distracted, right? So extending that analogy into knowledge, into guru, into our practice. I think there is a natural tendency, again, that kind of like fear exploitation dichotomy, the kind of to there's a beautiful verse in the fifth canto. I think it's the first verse of the fifth canto. And it describes it. Shukadeva Goswami lays out the whole situation. He lays out the whole situation in the material world that it's like a merchant who is going into the forest in order to find wood, You know, but in this, I'll actually, I want to look this up actually. I think it's 511. Let's see. 511SB. Let's see here.
As you look that up, I'll just, you know, I want to thank you for pulling us back to that point of hero's journey, right? That like we have to leave the fire at some point.
Yeah.
Even physically to our, you know, maybe our one sort of Diksha guru, you're going to leave them physically at some point. They're going to leave you at some point.
Yeah.
So that necessary step of going out into the world on your own and coming back with something. I'd like to maybe peel back some more of that and talk about how is that so different between men and women? You touched on that. There's something natural about our body types that make that different. But please, you found the verse?
I did find the verse, and then but I want to come right back to that because that's a great point. It's worth exploring, and it's I can share my screen. Hold on, real quick. Yeah. Okay. Can y'all see this? Can you see this?
I can see it.
Okay. Great. So the Sanskrit's in verse, so I won't chant it because I'll make a fool of myself. When King Parikshit asked Shukadev Goswami, this is 5.14.1, the first verse. The chapter is called the material world, like the I forget the name of the chapter actually. But he says this.
Creative impetus, I think it says at the top there.
Yeah, I think that's the whole the material world is a great force of enjoyment. Okay. So when King Pariksit asked Shukadeva Goswami about the direct meaning of the material forest, Shukadeva Goswami replied as follows. My dear King, a man belonging to the mercantile community, Vanik, is always interested in earning money. Sometimes he enters the forest to acquire some cheap commodities like wood and earth and sell them in the city at good prices. Similarly, the conditioned soul, being greedy, enters this material world for some material profit. Gradually, he enters the deepest part of the forest, not really knowing how to get out. Having entered the material world, the pure soul becomes conditioned by the material atmosphere, which is created by the external energy under the control of Lord Vishnu. Thus, the living entity comes under the control of the external energy, Daivi Maya, living independently and bewildered in the forest. So this is, I think, a really solid point. You're asking like the difference between the hero's journey and kind of the need of that. This is one thing, like living independently. What does it mean to, you know, always feel like you need direct instructions before to act, or you need to, you know, you can't make decisions in your life? No, it's more of the internal disposition. And again, I think like the intention. So living independently and bewildered in the forest, he does not attain the association of devotees who are always engaged in the service of the Lord. Once in the bodily conception, he gets different types of bodies, one after the other, under the influence of material energy, and impelled by the modes of material nature, Sattvagun, Rajagun, and Tamagun. In this way, the conditioned soul goes sometimes to the heavenly planets, sometimes to the earthly planets, and sometimes to the lower planets and lower species. Thus, he suffers continuously due to different types of bodies. These sufferings and pains are sometimes mixed. Sometimes they are very severe, and sometimes they are not. These bodily conditions are acquired due to the conditioned soul's mental speculation. He uses his mind and five senses to acquire knowledge, and these bring about the different bodies in different conditions. Using the senses under the control of the external energy, Maya, the living entity suffers the miserable conditions of material existence. He is actually searching for relief, but he is generally baffled, although sometimes he is relieved after great difficulty. Struggling for existence in this way, he cannot get the shelter of pure devotees who are like bumblebees engaged in a loving service at the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. And so just this too far away principle, too close, too far away. Sometimes on that hero's journey, one may indeed be very far away. But the thing that tethers us is the desire to stay close, the desire to orient, the desire to return. Right? I just read a very powerful book, Adam's Return, The Five Promises of Male Initiation by Richard Rohr. And it's called Adam's Return. And so this idea of returning to that garden, that one may go out, but the whole idea of hero's journey is that one has to return. One doesn't just stay wallowing, if you will, in a space of, well, I don't know and I can't. And that's again more of this like fear. It's the kind of unhealthy dependence. It's the lack of like the not taking the responsibility. When insight comes, when gifts come, when knowledge and wisdom and help and growth come, then I need to act upon that also. I need to respond accordingly. What is my ability to respond, my responsibility, right? So this idea of like being too close and kind of this ultra dependence where I'm just like, I need you. I need, you know, that will burn me. It'll burn me because I'm cheating myself. And I'm also just like objectifying again this person. That's a potential there. The like too far away where I'm not inclined to respond. I'm not engaging with my responsibility of like what knowledge and what wisdom and what insight is coming to me. That's also like the too far away where I become cold. What was this point that you brought up? Again, about the point I made about men and women.
Yes. Well, yeah. Firstly, thank you. Yeah, I can. That's a good verse to show, you know, the dangers of getting lost in the forest. If we don't have that intention, I think that you hit the money. You hit it right on the head when you said the intention to return. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something necessary, maybe especially for males. To find independence in some way, struggle,
yeah,
so that they can bring back a renewed sense of interdependence,
yeah,
the responsibility to tend the fire. And I also love that you know, fire as an element, it's dynamic, it's never the same. So if we think that guru is this static principle, this static element, I mean, how badly we've misconceived that fire is always going to be changing.
Yeah. Dancing.
Beautiful.
It's a dance. Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's a dance that needs to be continually engaged with.
I'd be really interested if there, you know, if we had some female voice to
hop
in the conversation. Because of course I would, you know, I'm sure some of our listeners want to know why and how does that journey look so different for men and women?
Yeah, I guess why? That's like, it's like Krishna's design, I guess, you know, and it's not that women don't create, like, don't perform great feats of austerity. Like, it's always dawning. It's dawning on me again and again, like just hearing the Mahabharata and really like the hero in so many ways is actually Draupadi. She's such, and the women of the Bhagavatam, I think we've done such a disservice, you know, in a very like male centric kind of culture often, to really not recognize the immense power and value of the feminine. I think that's like, it's like a chronic thing, like not only in a spiritual community, but in the community broadly. Again, it's either like the fear or the exploitation, but actually the feminine energy is everything. And from the feminine comes that illumination and comes that knowledge, right? Comes that wisdom and that guidance. So I think the, you know, in the context of the sharing that the perspective my wife had shared, where it's like, there's kind of this built in that initiation for women is often like any kind of women's rights in any traditional culture, not rites as R-I-G-H-T-S, but like rites of initiation, rites of passage. Those rites come like via puberty, via the sexual changes of their body, right? So in that way, again, they're like built in. Like a woman's body every month is going through a whole transformation and a cycle and feeling different things and like all the different hormones that are moving through the body. Like that's not easy. Like your body is constantly in flux and change, far more than a man's body is, right? And oftentimes those are things that are unavoidable for women, right? Whereas again, like men can avoid going on the vision quest. Men can avoid stepping up to be responsible for a family, for a partner. Like men can avoid that. It hurts them, but they can't avoid that. Whereas like generally women cannot avoid the initiations that their bodies will put them through.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
So I think that's like part of like the design. Like there's especially nowadays with all the comfort and convenience, like there's an opportunity for men to avoid the you know, this material world is hard. It's, you know, it's called Durga. It's difficult to go because it's meant to teach me who the center is and where I should be orienting, right? Again, like getting lost in the material world is the thought of, what did it say? You know, I become greedy, right? I'm greedy to try and take and exploit. And the material world is designed in such a way to accommodate some of that. And there are places where that can take place. But then there's also the counterbalance of that. So that is what this world is designed for. That's what these material bodies are designed for. And women have the good fortune of like having that built in. And that's why like the epitome of our culture is expressed in the like power, simplicity, beauty, surrender, and wisdom of the feminine. Like ultimately our culture is, it's the perfect balance of masculine and feminine, ideally, you know, but like that the epitome of our pryogena is embodied in the feminine. So yeah, I would love more feminine voices to, if there are anyone in the comments or anyone that can jump in, but just yeah. Some reflections.
I had a thought just the other day. I actually just returned from a men's spirituality retreat through Richard Rohr's organization called It was not so far from Ohio. It was in Illinois, but I had to drive through Ohio to get there.
You had to drive through us too. You didn't come say hi. What's
Next
going on?
Time I know I can stop.
Yeah, you got a space. You got a space there.
Thank you. And I had this reflection that, you know, our you know, we can't walk without both legs. In some ways, well, I'll just say, you know, the left often represents the feminine, the right often represents the masculine. We need both legs to move forward. Yeah. And I think built within to this Varnashram system, you know, like the period of Brahmachari is kind of embodies the feminine ideal in that you're receiving, you're really just a receiver for knowledge, for growth, for skills, you know, that's that student phase. Yeah. It's mostly about bringing in resources so that when you move into the next phase, now you're organizing those resources. They're putting them to use, you know? So maybe that moves one into more of a sort of masculine type of work in the world.
Mm.
And potentially that comes full circle, I think.
Yeah.
But I really, you know, that's so important. And I'm glad that we said that outright, that our pryogena, our system is really should be the ultimate balance between masculine and feminine, regardless of, you know, chromosomal differences.
Yeah.
That the spirit is really both.
Yeah. Richard Rohr talks about in that Adam's Return, and what is it, King
David or Solomon or
No, the king
oh, I
magician.
see.
King magician warrior. There's a fourth one. But
Lover.
in lover, thank you. Yeah, and these archetypes, like the pro yeah, the proper masculine is embodies both of those things, it nourishes both of those things. And I think unfortunately sometimes how the culture is kind of maybe interpreted or expressed that brahmachari phase is often it's often more in like the fear. That's at least kind of like culturally how that gets experienced. So even though it is a feminine container where a young man can learn to nourish the feminine, they will inherently do that because of the activities that they're engaged in. But I feel like so much is missed because of the emphasis on fear of the feminine, right? It's a feminine container where one is like learning to receive, to be utilized as an instrument, being receptive, being that yin, right? But often like if the external focus, and again, this is like we can expand this to any kind of situation in my life, like pain happens when I'm like resisting the inevitable, right? Like if I'm, you know, they give the examples of like it's kind of a maybe a darker example, but like drunk drivers who are like really intoxicated, oftentimes when they crash, like they're fine because their whole body being inebriated, they don't like resist against the like wrecking of the car. So they're not breaking bones and like pulling, you know, getting whiplash and all these things because they're just like receptive, right? So just kind of taking that as a metaphor of like when I'm resisting, like I give the, it's fall right now for most places in North America, right? And like if I'm resisting the fact the leaves are falling from the tree and I'm thinking, oh God, and I'm like picking up the leaves to try and like stitch them back onto the branches because I like my trees with leaves, right? That would be foolish and it would cause so much pain, right? There's a receptivity that needs to take place of like this is the season, right? And so similarly, like if brahmacharya is practiced from a place of fear of the feminine as opposed to like this is what is being like cultivated, right? Then something will be amiss, and then there will be a pain in the form of like unhealthy, you know, expectations when they like inevitably for most people like inevitably move into the grihastha ashram, this kind of like unhealthy dichotomy that's then created. So I think, you know, that's true for men and for women. Like if I resist the current situation that I find myself in, if it should be something different, if it like if you know it can't, this is the wrong thing, then I'm actually just creating more pain for myself as opposed to allowing the glorious yin of the feminine to receive the circumstance as it is.
Yeah, you made me think of like growing pains, really. I mean, we all go through that regardless of gender or sex.
Yeah. Totally.
I wonder, maybe I'll ask one more question. You know, as you've moved into this phase of fatherhood, so how does that change, you know, your purpose, or maybe to relate it to you know, those archetypes that Father Rohr talks about, lover, magician, king, warrior. Is there, do you feel that there's some, a real shift from maybe one of those archetypes to another, going from being primarily a partner pre-children to now being a father? Does one of those things take a primary role?
I think in this current season of my life, there's definitely an emphasis on that king quality. Like, how do I become more of a king, a provider, a protector? Not in a way that I feel like, you know, I think there's sometimes the trope, you know, around like, and it's there for sure, but like the father like being very protective of his daughter, and so I don't get that sense so much, although It is an awareness. People ask, and I had a friend that shared this with me of like, what is it like being a father? You know, and then the response that he would give, and this is something that I've taken up. It's like it's like seeing a new color. Like there's like a different emotional experience in the world. You're like seeing a new color. So that is there. But I think, yeah, in my life, what's really showing up is this like kingly quality of like shortening my like say to do ratio, like following through on the things that I say, like becoming more grounded as like a provider, and then like, you know, taking, you know, having the awareness that my sincerity and my approach to the fire of sacrifice, to the fire of prayer, my sincerity in that, that will be the thing that I share with my daughter, not the like empty religious ritual that I maybe create around my life, you know, because I'm unconscious of my actual like orientation and like directionality, right? That's, I don't want to create that type of environment where it's just like, we just do these religious things because that's like what we do. Like, I want to have a genuine connection to prayer and being able to authentically show up, because that's going to be what's conveyed. Like in my conversation with Padma Nava Maharaj, just this, you know, the responsibility of representing the perfect love of God for my daughter, so that she may know and understand Krishna loves me no matter what. And how do I know that? Because I've experienced that through my father.
Yes. Yes.
Right? So that's kind of that's the awareness and what's alive for me right now. It's like, yeah, that being that king, how do I really step into that like kinghood? Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, much of my, anyway, I don't want to keep rambling, but I appreciate the question.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, in so many real ways, the father and the mother are really the goddess and the god for a child.
Yeah.
There's not the awareness yet
yeah.
that there's some other higher power. And the highest power right now is probably, I don't know how old your daughter is, but it's probably
5 months.
Yes. So Ma is probably the highest power, and she doesn't even know about Pa, the provider, yet.
Yeah.
On some level.
Yeah, totally.
Then again, I don't have children, so there's a lot of growth that happens within every month and week.
Oh yeah, she just found her toes. That was pretty an amazing discovery. She found that she had toes, and what else did she discover? There was something else that was really exciting. She's been singing a lot more, which is glorious to watch.
Mm. That's so nice.
Letting it rip, especially at like 3 a.m. sometimes. So just like decide to sing. It's not like yelling. It's just like, you know, just like going. So it's cool.
That's great. That's great. You do make me think that, you know, let's say, you know, the man moving into Grahastha ashram, you know, if they haven't gained those capacities and those skills yet from brahmachari life, you know, how much more they need to actually rely on their partner. Because something that comes along with, you know, I'm taking directly from a few of our women speakers, forgive me for losing some names. I think Danya and Brenda Sundari.
Yeah.
You know, women also are usually more emotionally aware. So it's like when you use that idea that you're seeing a new color in your life, for a man, that might be tough to interpret. Like, I don't know how to put it into word, my feelings into words yet. In which case, we might want to rely on our left leg. We might want to rely on our feminine counterpart to help me interpret this feeling that I'm feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's so important to recognize how we need both legs.
Oh, totally. Yeah, again, I think that the real society is like it is that there's not like a question of like equality. It's just like it's just reality, the necessity of both, of the necessity of that polarity. There, I mentioned the unhealthy polarity of fear and exploitation. Like polarity will always exist at a chinja beta beta tava. This is the fabric of our reality, the simultaneous oneness and difference, and the way that those two things weave together. And so with the feminine and the masculine, those things have to be honored and discovered and deepened in terms of like that is our human work. Our human work is to understand the like interweaving of those things. And we will do, our generation will do well for the future if we in our specific spiritual communities can really cultivate a healthy dynamic between the male and the female. And that we can demonstrate that to our children and our children's, because still kind of so much of what we're inheriting still kind of reflects often the broken families of Kali Yuga. And so we will do a tremendous good to our specific Gaudiya community if we can really create healthy families and healthy dynamic between masculine and feminine, both externally and internally. Like that is our work, and that is a glorious task and a hefty one, I would say. And probably a whole nother conversation, but
Yeah,
that's fine.
thank you. I feel like there's so many threads to pick up on. We could go longer. I want to encourage anyone who's listening to, if you this here's your chance, your last chance, if you want to get
Yeah,
a question
any disagreement, any correction. If
in.
my wife's listening, she can correct me if I misrepresented her point.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, people will be able to comment on this video later, and I'm sure Ananda G would be happy to get into further conversations.
Totally.
We're at almost an hour. Is there any, based off of your theme, fatherhood and approaching the fire, is there any maybe final comments you'd like to leave us with?
I don't know. I feel like you said it. Like, I feel like there's a lot of threads, and I apologize if anything was less than fully coherent. But I hope again that something came through, something, whoever's listening, something that you can take away, that you can feel inspired and encouraged in your approach to the center, via the experiences that I'm currently having in my life.
Well, thank you so much, Ananda Murari. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, you as well.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting in person sometime.
Please come see our cows. Come see Goni Tai. It'd be so nice to see you in person.
Jai. Thank you, Prabhu.
Yeah, thank you.